of Christ as a myth, as a sort of fairy tale. Here's one, brilliant and famous scientist Stephen Hawking. If you know anything about Stephen Hawking, he suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease, a very twisted, mangled body, but inside that body, an extremely powerful intellect. Over the decades, it finally killed him. He was 76 years old when he died in 2018. But a robust mind inside that body, the tragedy is that Hawking identified as an atheist. He was an unapologetic critic of Christianity. Famously, he said, "I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark." Heaven is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And when he says fairy story, I think he means a fabricated story, especially one intended to deceive. That's one definition of a fairy story. Stephen Hawking believes heaven is a story made up by humans to deceive. It's a lie. So let's think about that, because this is a very brilliant guy. I suppose if you put all of our brains together, they might not match Stephen Hawking. I don't know. That's kind of an outlandish thing to say, but he's very, 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 very brilliant. How could such a brilliant person be mistaken about such a fundamental thing? Well, of course, that's not a big mystery, because intellect alone is not sufficient to find the truth. I don't say that the Bible is anti-intellectual. Of course, it's not at all. Actually, Christianity is the most rational, reasonable system of belief there is. It's the one credible explanation for reality as we see it. But like every belief system, it requires faith. You can't just figure your way out there intellectually. It requires faith. And of course, so does atheism. In fact, I believe atheism requires more faith than Christianity. Christianity is the only historically verifiable religion rooted in history, such as the resurrection, of course, the central point of the history of the world. We have multiple evidences of the history, of the truthfulness of the resurrection from history. And take it with the empty tomb, for example. That's a big one. Jesus really did physically rise from the dead. And the empty tomb is one of the biggest evidences of that. When Hawking calls Christianity a fairy story, he's just refusing to deal with this evidence. He's pushing it down. He's doing what the Apostle Paul called suppressing the truth. Whoops. So Paul says in Romans chapter 1, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them." So they suppress the truth like someone would push a jack-in-the-box down in there and close the lid and pretend that it's not there. That happens all the time. Hawking had a brilliant mind, but just to dismiss evidence such as the empty tomb because you've decided you're going to reject God, that's folly. And yes, there is such a thing as a very smart fool who suppresses the truth. The Jews of Jesus' day also suppressed the truth. Here's what that looked like. So in Jesus' day, they knew that Jesus had predicted that he was going to rise again on the third day. And so they decided to get ahead of this story and be prepared with a cover-up. We read in Matthew's account, Matthew 27, "The next day the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, 'Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, after 3 days I will rise. Therefore order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first.' Pilate said to them, 'You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can.' So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard." Jesus' enemies anticipated a lie. They believed that his followers were going to make up a story, that he had risen from the dead. So they decided to set a guard, and that's what they did. And if you read on from that passage in the next part, Matthew chapter 28, the first 8 or 10 verses, it shows the actual account of the resurrection. Well, actually, it doesn't. It shows that the resurrection has happened, and the guards fell down like dead men. They swooned at this vision of this angel coming who sat on the stone, and by the time they woke up, it was all over. And it was the enemies who told the lie. Here's the fairy tale. So here's what's happened next. So the guards go back. No, I'm sorry. While Jesus witnesses, his followers were going to tell the others what had happened. Behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. And I think it would be accurate to read, this fairy story has been spread among the Jews to this day. This fairy tale, because it wasn't true, of course, for one thing. Try saying that in court. While I was asleep, so-and-so did this. You were asleep and he did this while you were asleep. Maybe Hawking would side with the Jews here who said that Jesus' disciples had stolen the body. But he was a scientist. He would have known that all the Jews had to do was find the body and produce it and say, no, he didn't rise from the dead. Here's his body, and just parade it through the streets. And they had all the resources. The elites, the leaders of the day, they had all the power. They had all the resources. The disciples didn't have any power. They were powerless, but nobody was to be found. There was no dead body. There had been a dead body, but there wasn't now. There was a live body, but they needed a dead one. Here's another reason the explanation doesn't hold up, that his disciples stole the body. If they did that and made up a story of the resurrection, how do you explain the transformation that came in the lives of Jesus' followers from this point on? Take it with Peter. Remember what Peter did when Jesus was on trial and Peter was standing around a fire with a group of ordinary people? And someone said, a young woman said, "I think I saw you with him. I think you're one of his followers." You remember what he said? What did he say, folks? It's okay to answer. "No, I don't know him." That's right. He betrayed him 3 times. Betrayed him with curses, finally. He was afraid. Out of fear, Peter betrayed Jesus. But after he saw Jesus alive, and after he received the Holy Spirit, he was a different Peter. He boldly stood up before the same Jews in Jerusalem. You can read it in Acts chapter 2. And he said to them, "You put him to death by nailing him to the cross, but God raised him from the dead." How do you explain that transformation in the life of someone who's promoting a lie, who knows that didn't happen, who said, "Well, let's steal his body and we'll tell everybody that he rose from the dead"? In fact, of course, Peter's life ended in a very brutal way. He submitted to crucifixion rather than betray Jesus. In fact, all of the 11 disciples, 11 apostles, 12 if you include Paul, except John, all of them met a very violent martyr's death. In fact, the next generation of Christians went singing to the lions rather than betray Jesus. Who does that for a lie? Maybe Hawking would say, "Well, the people were hallucinating when they saw Jesus." But that doesn't work either, because Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15, 500 people saw him at the same time. So there's no such thing as a crowd hallucination. And then the way that Christianity flourished after in the first century, as the news spread, the unlikely growth of early Christianity, of the early church, is another powerful evidence of the truth of the gospel, the truth of the resurrection. So sorry, Mr. Hawking, the only explanation that makes any sense is that Jesus really did rise from the dead. And there may be somebody who's listening to the sound of my voice right now who is sort of hawking in your persuasion, sort of thinking, yeah, I don't really believe this. That's probably not the case, or you wouldn't be listening to an Easter sermon either here or on the phone, the radio, or on the internet later. But there may be somebody, so I appeal to you along those lines to reconsider. But I'm supposing that most people who are listening to me are not like Stephen Hawking. You're not wondering, did Jesus really rise from the dead? It may be, though, that for some people at least who go to church on Easter Sunday or even every Sunday, the question is more like this. Okay. So an ancient rabbi died and then came back from the dead. 2,000 years later, what difference does it make? If that's your question, and I think it is the question of some, if we honestly search our heart, this sermon is for you, beloved. I want you to see not only that the resurrection is true, but that it's the most wonderful thing that's ever happened. The truth and the power of the resurrection lies behind every joy and wonder. All the stories that we tell that are too good to be true, all the fairy tales that we love, all those made-up fairy tales are just echoes of this one ultimate wonderful story. It has all the wonder and power of a fairy tale, and yet it is true. In fact, if you define fairy tale, as I showed earlier, a fabricated story intended to deceive, well, the resurrection is not a fairy tale. Hawking is wrong. Heaven is not a fairy tale. It's not a lie. The resurrection is the truest thing that's ever happened. But that's not the only definition of a fairy tale. Here's another definition: an incredible statement, account, or belief. A fairy tale is also defined as an incredible statement or account or belief, or another way to say it, something that's too good to be true. Well, by that definition, heaven is a fairy tale. The resurrection is a fairy tale. Extraordinary, hard to believe, but not a lie. It's true. One of the marks of a good fairy tale is that it's too good to be true. And one fairy tale is true. You may know the name J.R.R. Tolkien, who was a master at telling fairy tales, writer of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. Here's what he says about the resurrection. The Gospels contain a fairy story. And now, speaking of the resurrection, he says, there is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true. This story is supreme, and it is true. And the rest of this sermon is we're going to see what that looked like in the first century. And I believe that almost certainly you have had an experience of something that came true in your life, even though it was too good to be true. You might have to search your memory a little bit. What if something that was too good to be true actually turned out to be true after all? Lots of true stories are too good to be true, but they actually happened. Here's one that I well remember from my late teens. Somebody that I loved, somebody that I had loved for a couple of years already, who I knew would never share that mutual feeling, actually fell in love with me. That was too good to be true, and I clearly remember it. Or you were told you couldn't have children, but you did. That's true of one of us here. Or the doctor said a loved one would not recover, but they did. Or dozens of people applied for that dream job, and you got it. Or you prayed for years that a friend would come to repentance, and it looked like it's never going to happen, and then it did. See, that's just a very quick list of things that are echoes of this ultimate fairy tale, the resurrection. It's too good to be true, but it is true. We celebrate it every Easter, every Sunday. we celebrate this story that when no one was expecting it, not even his closest friends, an ancient Israeli rabbi came out of a tomb. After being brutally flogged, horribly executed, pronounced dead, taken down from a cross, wrapped in grave clothes, put in a tomb, sealed with a huge stone, where his body lay for 3 days, he came back to life. He actually rose from the dead. Death led to life. Life exists beyond the grave. Nothing can compare to that, beloved. It's the ultimate story of hope. The ultimate story of a fairy tale come true. But that story has lost its power for many people. It's kind of a ho-hum thing in the lives of too many people. And maybe for somebody who's listening to me right now. So in your best moments on Easter Sunday in church, okay, that's cool, preacher, I'm good with that. You know, I can take it that far. But I've got problems. Yeah. That was 2,000 years ago. I live in the real world. You don't know my story. Preacher, you don't know what I put up with. And that's true, I don't. And you may be living with relationship issues, with some big personal burden, with health problems, addictions, grief, money problems. So for you, Easter, well, yeah, it's a great story. I guess I believe it. But what difference does it make? You know, I'm here because everybody goes to church on Easter Sunday, but really, so what? So if that's your story, beloved, stay with me here. You have much in common with the people in this story that Claire read to us a little while ago. Their world was dark and empty. It was about to become bright and beautiful, but it wasn't yet. It was the first Easter, and they were sad. Did you see that in verse 17? I hope you still have Luke 24 open in front of you. Look at verse 17, last part of the verse. They stood still, looking sad. Jesus asked them a question. They're sad. They're grieving. Their hearts are very heavy. A little later, their grief was going to turn to joy. And that's the message of the Bible, beloved. Beauty comes from ashes. God brings life from death. From the deepest grief can come the highest joy. So let's just look at this story. Let's just read the first part of it. Look at verse 13, just to kind of refresh what's going on here and review. So that very day, two of them were going to a village named Emmaus. So Emmaus is 7 miles from Jerusalem in a westerly direction. And two of them are walking along this road, walking path, on their way to Emmaus. And it's Sunday. We see that earlier in the week. It's the first Easter Sunday. Jesus has risen, but they don't know that. Verse 14, they're talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you are holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people." So we have this conversation now at the end of the story. We have these two guys on the one hand and Jesus on the other hand. The resurrection has happened, but they don't know it. Jesus is standing right there in front of them, but they don't know it. And they have at the heart of the story this conversation. They say something, and Jesus replies. They tell Jesus their sad story. He's going to tell them the glad truth. They talk about the past. He speaks of the present. They tell him about the last 3 years, the last 3 days, and the last 12 hours. So pick it up again in verse 19. They said to him concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. This was an amazing person. And many of us had become his followers. And we were so caught up in this. We were so blessed by him. He was a truly amazing person. The blessing and the wonder of the last 3 years. But then they go on to talk about the horror of the last 3 days. How, verse 20, and how our chief priest and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. They were stunned. Jesus' followers were stunned and shocked to see the events that played out in that last 3 days. How could this be? How could we have been so wrong? It wasn't supposed to end like this. They were followers of the Messiah. Everyone knew what the Messiah was going to do. The Messiah was going to bring deliverance to Israel. He was going to chase away the Roman overseers and bring freedom once again to God's covenant people. And we were all set up for that. He even rode into Jerusalem as a triumphant king and was proclaimed king. And he put down the Pharisees and said, you tell these people to stop. And he said, if I tell them to be quiet, if they're quiet, the stones are going to cry out. All this was going so wonderfully, and then all of a sudden, it all went away. He's dead. He's dead. And then topping off the last 3 days was the confusion of the last 12 hours. Verse 22, moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. Him they did not see. The writer's irony there is inescapable, isn't it? There they are telling Jesus that nobody can see him. Nobody has seen him. So they've gone from 3 years of wonder to 3 days of horror to 12 hours of confusion, and their hopes are dashed. Verse 21, but we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. Obviously, we were wrong. It's not going to happen. He's dead. It's too late. It's all over. Our hope is gone. We were hoping for too much, and now it's over. Do you know what it is to lose hope? Most of us have been at least tempted to lose hope. We've been in situations where hope is hard to come by. Many people are losing hope today as the war drags on in Ukraine, of course. 3+ million people who have been who have left the country to escape war. The prayer request I noted earlier from the bulletin about the radical Fulani herdsmen who are persecuting Christians in Nigeria. In October, a faithful brother in China who was distributing Christian literature was imprisoned for that crime and is almost certainly facing a long prison sentence. In such situations and scenarios, it would be easy to lose hope. Or take it right here. You know, what are you hoping for? And how have your hopes been dashed? Maybe you're grieving. Maybe you're hurting. I was working on this, and I remembered about Nadia's brother who died in Russia last summer. From here, from Vancouver. Or someplace in Washington. He went over there to visit family and died. What an unthinkable thing. Susan's cancer is untreatable. She keeps smiling. The Messings can't find housing. Sharon said goodbye to her beloved Melinda, her surrogate mom. Or right next door here in Gresham, some of you will recognize the name Randy Alcorn, author of lots of wonderful Christian books, and blessed many, many people. He just lives about 3 miles from here in a normal house. And 3 weeks ago, he said goodbye to his lifelong bride, Nancy, after colon cancer took her. You know, like every happily married couple, they hope to grow old together. And now that prospect is gone. These two guys walking on the road here, we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. And now that hope is gone. That's one side of the conversation. What has happened in the past, in the experience of these humans, these Christ followers, crushed hopes. So what about the other side of the conversation? What does Jesus say to that? How does he respond? Well, he says a couple of things. In verse 25, you could rephrase it like this. You have a heart problem. You're not believing God. Look at verse 25, and he said to them, "Oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." You're foolish, so that's a mind problem, and you're slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Both the intellect and the heart are part of Christianity, are part of a life of following Jesus. You remember at the beginning I said every system requires faith, and of course Christianity requires faith. And if you're dull of mind, if you're foolish and dull of mind and your heart is slow to believe, then you don't see what God is doing all around you. And that's so clearly presented there because their eyes were prevented from seeing him. There's like a big surprise coming for these guys. But at this point in the story, they don't realize they're talking to the very one that they've given up hope because he's gone. He's dead. They don't even see that he's there. And that's a great picture of how we can be today. We don't see God at work in our lives. We think he's left us. And we despair. Our perspective isn't what it should be. Our faith suffers. So that was true then. It's still true today. And then he says in verse 26, everything is on track, but the story isn't over. 26, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? The prophets told you this, he says. We were around the table this morning over there at breakfast talking about this because it came up at the Seder meal on Friday evening. And if you read this, I'll just say it this way. I can't not think of Isaiah 53 when he says, the prophets told you this. Isaiah 53:3, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And now he stands before two travelers on the road to Emmaus, and he says, you're slow to believe the prophets. You guys should have seen this. It's all on track, and it's not over. What you thought was a disaster is exactly what God has planned. Glory is coming. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? Joy is coming, and not only for Jesus, but for all who love him. You see, Jesus' resurrection makes all the difference. You ask, what difference does it make 2,000 years later? It makes all the difference. When you grasp the power of Jesus' resurrection, you begin to understand what God has done, that he has done just as he planned. He's renewed the world. He started history all over, a brand new history, by reversing death. It's not complete. It's the already not yet kingdom. It's already here, but not yet in its fullness. And he is bringing it to pass. The renewal has happened. Jesus has risen from the dead. Cleopas and his friend were sad because they had lost sight of the big picture. When that picture became clear, they were ignited with joy, and not because their circumstances had changed. That's an important thing to remember here. Things didn't change overnight for them. They still wanted Israel to be redeemed, but now everything's different. Jump then to verse 32. So they walk along. Jesus explains all the things in the scriptures about him. They come near the village. He acts like he's going farther, but they say, no, please come stay with us. So he goes in. He takes the bread and blessed it and broke it. I'm in verse 30. The bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. Verse 31, and their eyes were opened and they recognized him and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road and while he opened to us the scriptures? And then jump down. We have a minute. Let's just read from 36, a parallel account that follows this one. So they rush back to Jerusalem. They just went 7 miles. They turn right around and go right back to Jerusalem to tell the rest of the disciples. Verse 36, as they were talking about these things. So they get there. They tell them what happened. They were talking about these things. Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, peace to you. But they were startled and frightened and thought they saw a spirit. He said to them, why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still disbelieved for joy and were marveling. Stop. They were still looking for the redemption of Israel, but now they can't believe what's happened because of their joy and amazement. It was too good to be true. It was like a fairy tale. But it was true. Jesus' death and Jesus' resurrection were part of God's plan to restore not just Israel, but the whole human race and the whole creation. Israel's redemption was not too much to hope for. It was too little. God was doing something much bigger than all their little troubles, and somehow they got that. On that Easter, they understood that the resurrection was bigger than all their troubles. Nothing could be bigger than this. The ultimate fairy tale had come true. That's the story, beloved. I wonder how about you. I wonder, do you see this wonder? Or are you still in verse 17, standing still, looking sad? You see, it's Easter, but maybe you're burdened with grief and trouble. Maybe you're thinking, really, what difference does it make? And I wonder what Jesus would say to you. Would he say, oh, foolish one and slow of heart to believe? Jesus' resurrection is bigger than all your troubles. The grace of God can allow us to transcend our earthly life. I do not mean that it doesn't matter. I do not mean that it's all a shadow. It's real. Our lives are real. Our circumstances are real. But God's grace through Jesus, pictured at the resurrection, his power, can bring us to transcend that. And when we're slow of heart to believe, we miss the wonder of the resurrection. Humans have been slow of heart since Adam and Eve. The serpent said to them, do you really think you can trust God? And they bought that lie. And we don't. We don't trust God. We choose our own way. It doesn't feel safe to trust God. He might not take care of me. So you miss the power of the resurrection because you don't trust God. You don't believe that God can care for you, but he will, even though you don't deserve it. Nobody has earned his way or her way to God. It's not your merit. It's the merit of another. One who prayed alone in the garden, Father, please grant that this cup may pass from me, as he faced the cross. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what you will. And God did not let the cup pass. God said, you must drink the cup. And he went to the cross. And he fell into a pit of abandonment so that you can be raised to stand before a throne. He beat death. And nothing else matters, beloved. Everything is on track, but the story isn't over. Easter is the fairy tale that is true. Jesus is alive. I don't see him, you say. Well, Cleopas and his friend didn't see him either, but he was right there. He's there in your sorrows. He's there in your sickness. We still live in a fallen world. He's there when loved ones disappoint you or break your heart. These are the realities, but none of them is the end of the story. The story ends in inconceivable glory and joy because Jesus rose from the dead. And by the way, how does every fairy tale end? Everyone lived happily ever after. Where do you suppose that idea came from? Well, one who said, "I am the resurrection," Martha. "My brother, I know that my brother will rise again at the last day." Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And to kind of come full circle, here's what that looks like in the life of a true Jesus follower. Randy wrote, after his bride had passed to eternity, he wrote, "Nancy is and always will be an inspiration to me. I am with family and friends now, thanking God for his grace and the promises of Jesus that we will live with him forever in a world without the curse, and he will wipe away all the tears and all the reasons for the tears. All God's children really will live happily ever after. This is not a fairy tale. It is the blood-bought promise of Jesus." And I submit to you, beloved, that when you can't see the end of your trouble, when you're burdened and confused, just remember the resurrection of Jesus is true. He has turned death backwards. He's in the process of making the world new. Everything else is details. He's going to make everything bad come untrue. Hallelujah. And let's respond with singing a wonderful hymn, the resurrection hymn. I'll invite Sharon to come join me and invite you to stand and sing with us.